This is Artist Stories, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County. I'm your host, Ava Romero. So today, I'm with Mele Martinez, wife, mother, flamenca, writer, Chicana, daughter, poet, teacher, sister, believer, cousin, Tucsonan. Welcome, Mele.
Hello.
Mele, I would love to hear about your trajectory with writing, as well as your trajectory with flamenco. But let's start with flamenco. And if you could just tell us about how this Tucson Chicana came to dedicate such a huge part of her life to a cultural form from southern Spain. Pre-internet.
When I was three, I started dancing. I probably danced a little bit before that, but I started taking dance classes from Leticia Durazo. She had a studio here in Tucson. And I learned mostly folklorico, Mexican folklorico. I learned a little bit of Spanish classical dancing and ballet and tap and some other forms. And it was my favorite thing to do. Every Monday, I got to go to dance class. It was my favorite day of the week. And I think from just a young age, I knew that I had some talent for it. And I was very, very, very interested in getting better and learning more. When I was about 12 or 13, I think, is when Leticia invited some guest teachers in, and one of them gave a choreography to our class that was with music that was rumba flamenca, Gypsy Kings. And the Gypsy Kings were very popular at that time. And we learned some basic movement, but it was actually really interesting for me to start that way, because it wasn't pure flamenco the way that most people consider flamenco now. And it also wasn't Spanish classical. It was kind of this free form that's in between. And it was actually a really good way to start. I ended up getting some instruction on the basics of flamenco, but there wasn't a whole lot in Tucson offered when I was that age, or at least I didn't know about anything. A group of dance students and I went to Albuquerque for the International Flamenco Festival. And that's really where I began to understand what flamenco was. And being really young, I was very fascinated by everything. So I was very invested from that moment on.
You went to the festival, and for people who maybe aren't familiar with the Albuquerque Flamenco Festival, it attracts high caliber artists from all over the world, and it has quite a history. So this festival kind of opened a flamenco world for you. You continued to go to the festival.
Well, there was one year they had to skip, but for the past 26 years, I've gone for the past 25 festivals. So for 25 consecutive festivals, I've been there, which should be a testament to how important this festival is, and kind of how it kind of shows how a person who is from the Southwest actually can be immersed in flamenco and the art form, even without, you know, being a person who has to live in Spain or who moves to Spain. I know many, many flamenco artists from the United States do choose to do that. And it's a wonderful way to learn, but it's actually not the only way. I knew from a young age that I wasn't going to be the type of person to really move to Spain and live in Spain as much as I loved flamenco. The Southwest is my home, and my identity truly is rooted here.
How old were you when you joined Hijastros?
I joined the American Flamenco Repertory Company, which is called Hijastros, when I was, I believe, 20. I had just finished college. I just graduated with my undergrad, and I moved to Albuquerque. I auditioned for the company. At the same time that I auditioned was a group of about five or six young men and women, and we embarked on this kind of crazy experiment to do flamenco in an American dance format, which is basically to have a body of artists who are mounting or have material mounted that is continuing for years and years rather than just project by project. And so that company, directed by Joaquin Encinas, was probably the first of its kind in many ways. And so it truly was kind of like an experiment. My husband, Jason, also auditioned at the same time. And we ended up getting married while we were in the company and had a child while we were in the company. I think we were the first to do that. And now the company has, I believe, probably over 15 or 20 dancers, different levels of dancers. And some of the people that were in the group when we were part of the group are still there and are doing really tremendous work with the company.
So what was it like to bring a baby into the company?
Yeah, that was fun. Being a dancer and having a baby are kind of a crazy alliance that actually works really well sometimes. And I certainly was frightened, and I certainly was unsure of what it meant for me in terms of my work in the company. But luckily for me, the directors and all of the people who work at National Institute of Flamenco, I think we're very much open to the concept of anyone that worked with them or for them having children. And I would say that's because they're a family that runs a nonprofit organization. So they understand that concept. It's not a foreign one to them. They're not afraid of that idea. And it was a very welcoming atmosphere to have a child in. It was also very intense and a little bit isolating because I was the only person in the company who had children. Besides the directors. And so it was difficult. I'm not going to lie and say that, oh, it was all easy peasy. But I was lucky that I was young. And so my body was able to, I think, get through some of those struggles. I think a lot of women's bodies actually are able to do it. We just don't believe that we can.
Let's fast forward a little bit to the Tucson Flamenco Festival.
The Tucson Flamenco Festival started as a collaboration between myself and my husband, the dance company that we were creating here in Tucson when we came back from being in Hijastros, and the family that owned Casa Vicente. Together, we knew that we had a venue. We knew that we had people who enjoyed flamenco. We knew that we had a flamenco community of both students and aficionados. And so we wanted to bring outside talent to Tucson so that the Tucson community could start to see what flamenco is about and why it's so special to us. It was a great festival. It had a great run. We were able to invite many different, I would say probably a couple dozen different artists, all of them fantastic performers, almost all of them American, and it was great. It was a great festival. We had a really nice group of people who supported it year after year, and it was a growing experience for my husband and I, for sure, to understand how to actually run a festival, how to curate material, how to choreograph on students and have students be side by side with professional dancers on a stage, how to do an outdoor festival at the end of the summer. That was all really, really fun stuff.
Are there any chances of the festival reemerging?
I would love for the festival to come back. I'm glad it stopped when it did, because we did have other things, but it would be great to have it back, even in a small form, because the Tucson community really does need to see this artistry happening in the rest of the country, especially in the rest of the Southwest. And I know that people in Tucson would appreciate it. I know that probably some young kids like me would see it and say, oh my gosh.
Well, I'd love to see it come back.
Yeah, that would be great. Let's do it. Ready? You and me, Eva. We'll make the festival.
Could you tell us about Luz?
Yes, Luz is what I got to do after the festivals in Tucson were put on hold. My husband and I had our first child while we were in Hijastros. And then 8.5 years later, we had another baby. And right before our second daughter was born, I had kind of these ideas about, or changing maybe perspectives about, what it means to be an artist and a mom. I had been at that point, you know, an artist and a mom, actually doing it for, you know, over 7 years. And I didn't think about it a whole lot in the beginning. It was just something that I moved through. It was like, this is the phase, I'm going through the phase. And I didn't really take a whole lot of time to reflect on what was happening or see the impact of what was happening on me, on my child. And we just kind of went through the motions. And I didn't really want to do that again with my second kid. I kind of wanted to understand the connection between motherhood and artistry. And lucky for me, flamenco is an art form that actually speaks really, really well into the concepts of motherhood. And so Luz was a project born out of my desire to honor mothers who are in the arts. And we started it by simply mounting some pieces, considering, you know, what kind of musicians to bring in, and have all of it really be a reflection of a solo project for a mom. But it was more about, what does it mean to be a mom in flamenco? And so in a lot of ways, I was trying to represent different kinds of motherhood and artistry. Fanny Ara was my co-choreographer, and I had a cast of fantastic musicians to work with as well. And it took about a year or so to create the basics of the project. And then we did a tour of it in a few weeks. We mounted everything with the musicians, and we were able to tour a couple of cities in California, Arizona, and also in Albuquerque, which was really special to be there too. Because I had worked so much on my own to create Luz, because actually my co-workers in the project all lived in California, I was isolated all the time. And that was kind of a strange experience for doing flamenco, because that's not the way flamenco works, right? Flamenco is about community. And so because of that, I think I was able to be a little bit more reflective. And I did end up doing some blogging about the process. And that ended up being one of the more important ways that I was able to reach a lot of flamenco artists throughout the country who were not able to see the show, to bring up these ideas about what does it mean to make time for both motherhood and artistry. How do flamenco artists specifically, how do these women who have children make a way to go on tour for months at a time, you know, with young children at home? So that was one of the ideas that would pop up. Also issues about the body, how the body has changed, what's acceptable on a stage, what's acceptable for beauty when it comes to flamenco. Those lines get blurred a little bit compared to, I would say, other dance forms. Flamenco is a lot more open and liberal with what a body can do on a stage and what's acceptable for beauty in that way. But it was just a really great opportunity for me to put in words and share with people publicly, socially, about this process that I had been going through for the 8 years that I had been a mom. And then because I had a second child, to kind of see how it kind of compounds, right? When you have more than one kid, everything starts to compound a little bit.
Where, if I may ask, can we catch you performing now?
Now, I'm happy to say my husband and I still get to perform. We have two kids and we have full-time jobs, and we still get to do flamenco, which is amazing. Not to the extent that we were doing it before, but we do get to perform now at Exo Bar, which is part of Exo Coffee. And they have a performance space in their bar area that is open to many different musical acts, and they've graciously been hosting us this last year, and now starting again in the fall, we'll do monthly shows.
When we were talking previously, you had mentioned that flamenco is more of a lifestyle instead of just perhaps a dance form. It doesn't exist just in a silo that way. It's more about community. It's more about family. It's more about growing old. You don't age out of flamenco as, you know, people think about aging out of ballet or something. Could you talk to us a little bit more about that, and also about how it makes flamenco perhaps a more capacious dance genre in terms of different body types or different genders?
Sure. So many people, I would say, call flamenco a lifestyle because it's because it's a full culture that kind of reaches every part of somebody's life. So the way that you move around the world has something to do with flamenco if you're a flamenco artist. The way that you perceive everything about culture, the way you eat, the way you spend time with your family, all of those things can be influenced and can also influence somebody's understanding of flamenco. Because flamenco is about a communication that happens between people, it automatically makes it about community. So the way that most flamenco traditionally is done, especially in Spain, is not necessarily in performance, but in family gatherings. And so that translates a bit in the United States, not to the extent that it does in Spain, because there are no full clans of flamenco necessarily here. But there still is, you know, this room for the concept of flamenco as being not just something I do when I put on my shoes and go into a studio or when I get on a stage. And pretty much everyone gets included in that. It doesn't really matter if you're an outsider in some way, or maybe you're perceived outsider in some way. Flamenco is inclusive in terms of, well, do you know how to move your body? Because as long as you know how to move your body, and as long as you understand some concepts about rhythm, then you're part of the party. You're part of that community. You're part of that speaking to each other. And I would say what's really amazing about flamenco is there's this embedded appreciation for the unique, right? So although people really like to see similarities, aesthetic similarities, and that's actually how we start to define what looks flamenco and what doesn't look flamenco, those things are important, but also there's this openness in flamenco for understanding somebody's personality shining through those aesthetics. So, for example, if you are the type of person who always dances with your head in a strange position, you might be actually kind of celebrated in a way, right? Or if you're the type of person who understands some really beautiful concepts in flamenco, but your body doesn't necessarily easily translate that, then you might be appreciated even more, right? So if you can't move your arm or if you don't have an arm, it's actually okay in flamenco. There's some aspect of that that would be celebrated, openly celebrated and appreciated in flamenco. So I mean, it's a little different in the United States because so much of flamenco that we understand here is performance and is stage. But the heart of flamenco, I would say, it has that openness.
That's beautiful. All right, switching gears a little. Could you tell us about your path to writing?
I started writing when I was a little kid, the way most human beings do. And I think my first understanding of maybe kind of the beauty of words or the fascination with words probably had to come from some feeling way deep inside that I didn't feel very confident communicating, that I wasn't very good at communicating. And there was something about words that helped me understand, you know, even though I'm struggling with these things, they're also things to figure out. And so I was drawn to words in that way. And rather than creating my own poems necessarily as a kid, one of the things that I did a lot was I would just copy the words of other people. I think sometimes I wanted to just work on my penmanship, but there was also like this feeling of writing down words that in some sense gave me some ownership of them, even if they weren't mine. And then storytelling was a whole nother part of what was happening. So even though I felt some struggle with words and with communication, storytelling is something that just happened in my family, and I would say most families, from when I was really young. And it seemed really natural, actually so natural that I really didn't even consider anybody in my family a quote-unquote storyteller. Like that, I never even used that word. It was just the way we operated. So those two things combined probably is what made me want to become a writer. And I loved literature, even though I wasn't a good reader. I wasn't a reader. I was kind of scared of books for the most part. I got usually very frustrated with books when I couldn't identify with anything in them, which was almost every book. that I was ever assigned in school. They assign better books now, but in my experience, there wasn't a whole lot that I felt like I could latch on to. Part of me was closed-minded to that, too. You know, I wasn't necessarily interested in something that was so spectacular that I had never heard of those words, and it was a lot of work for me to read a book. I remember three books that I read by the time I was graduating from high school. I read a Nancy Drew book when I was pretty young. I was really, really proud of myself for finishing that in the summer by myself without anybody telling me to read it. And amazingly, I'm still fascinated by mystery. And then I read, I don't know how I got a hold of this, but I read The Color Purple sometime when I was in my teenage years. And that was a fascinating read, and easy to find myself in there, which was kind of strange because it was totally different than where I grew up. But yeah, the universality of that one was important. And then, of course, the most important one to me was The House on Mungo Street. And I didn't know books like that existed. When I read House on Mungo Street, I was so blown away by the fact that someone who had some similarities to me could actually put something in a book and that it would actually count as a book was mind-blowing. So it was my favorite thing to read. And then when I got into college, I was encouraged to take classes in the things and major in the things that were going to get me a job, obviously, because I came from working class family who had never had a college graduate in the family before. So I was encouraged that way. Of course, I was still doing flamenco, so my brain was mostly on flamenco, and I was going to college because I knew I needed to. And I would say by the end of my freshman year in college, I realized that I was not going to continue unless I was able to take some classes that I was inspired by. And the only classes that I was inspired by were creative writing classes. So even though I had no dreams about becoming a writer, I had no inclination to believe that I was the type of person who could be a writer, I knew one thing, and that was if I majored in creative writing, I'd probably finish school. So that's what I did. And I got my bachelor's in creative writing at the University of Arizona. And the last semester that I was studying there, I was taking a creative nonfiction class, and I wrote an essay about my family. And it was not a topic that I had ever really thought too much about before that. I was more interested in fiction at that time. And when I wrote it, I had no idea the impact that it would have for me later on. But that's the work that I'm continuing to do, is to write about some specific stories about my family.
So you went on to continue your writing education after your undergraduate degree at the University of Arizona.
Yes, I went on to get my MFA at Goucher College.
Could you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, that was a very strange experience. I was encouraged to go to graduate school. I didn't really even understand the purpose of graduate school, even when I was in college, because I tell you, this college world was foreign to me. It was a foreign world. No one in my family talked about what the purpose of college was, what it was like. I just didn't understand those things. But I was encouraged, and I knew that I wanted to do some more writing. So I applied everywhere I could for creative writing programs, and the only program that accepted me was Goucher College's nonfiction program. It was a long distance, it was a low residency program, and so I didn't have to move to Maryland to be part of it. I only went to the school for a couple of weeks during the summer for workshops and things, and then I worked remotely. And the first time that I went to Goucher in Maryland, I realized that most of the people who were in the program also lived either somewhere in Maryland or D.C. or on the East Coast. There was many, many people from the East Coast there. And at the time, I don't know that there was anyone from my region. And so it was alienating. It was strange, and it was difficult. Most of the people who were students were older than me. I was in my mid-20s. Most of them were, I would say, probably wealthier than I was, or at least it seemed that way. They were mostly white. They were mostly women. And there was a wonderful community there, but not one that I necessarily felt immediately welcomed into or even understood. I feel like a lot of the conversations that happened were pretty academic, and I was not really from an academic world. I was able to get through college, but I was not from an academic world. And so the talk about English studies and the talk about language and even books that I had never even heard of was scary to me. And so it was difficult. I did end up doing some good writing there, and I did have some great mentors. But I also had times when folks would read my material, and I think as much as they wanted to appreciate it, there was some loss in translation for a lot of things. I was speaking English and writing English, mm-hmm. but not everything translates. And so when I would write things that made sense to me, I think it was very, very foreign to them. And so we struggled. We struggled to communicate. And I don't know that that's a decision I would have made again. I think it was great for what it was. But it probably stalled me a little bit in my confidence in my own writing, just because I was entering this book and writing world that it was so foreign and unfamiliar to me.
Ramada,
yes. So I told you about the word Ramada. So I wrote a story that had the word Ramada in it. And I can't remember exactly what the scenario was that I was in, but I do remember people saying, "What is a Ramada?" There's these different audiences that we can actually choose to write for or not write for. And Ramada, as customary a word as it seems to many Tucsonans, was not a word that translated easily. So when I tried to explain Ramada, it was it was a failure in all respects. You can't say tent. You can't say gazebo, right? None of these things quite match what a Ramada is. It's like every time someone would ask me what this thing was, which actually wasn't just the word Ramada, but many other words, the only thing I could think of doing was showing them a picture, because I truly did not have the words to translate what I was saying. That was very frustrating. And but it also taught me about, you know, this concept of audience and who is it that I'm actually writing for. And it took me a long time to realize that I did not have to write for an audience that doesn't know what that word means.
And then you went on to teach at the University of Arizona.
Yes.
And at Pima Community College as
right.
well.
Ironically, I became part of the academic world. So I went to teach at Pima Community College first, and I knew nothing. And I think some of my students knew more about grammar than I did. And that was, you know, 9-10 years ago. And so I, over the past several years, going from Pima and then to the University of Arizona, I feel like I've gotten another education in what it means to write.
You had mentioned to me that with the essay that was one of your early versions of your memoir, that you had won some awards. Mm-hmm. And that was also something that really kept you moving forward.
Yes.
And I think that sometimes people get a little cynical about the competitions, but there really is a lot of energy that a person can get from interacting
for sure.
with a competition and having a good outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think through my education and writing programs, even though I had some great feedback, I don't know that I would have felt confident enough to continue writing if I hadn't earned a few awards along the way that kind of, in my mind at least, solidified the idea that I was doing something that was good and I could continue doing that, and that it was valuable and that it was understood or that it was respected in some way. I think that's probably what every writer is yearning for, is that someone would understand what they put down on paper. And so to have that recognition made a huge impact on me. So the first one that I got, which helped me, I think, have the confidence to even apply for an MFA, was Fourth Genres Literary Prize. And that was some years ago. And it was on the first essay that I had written for the memoir that I'm writing about my family. And I wrote that in Allison Deming's creative nonfiction class my last year at the University of Arizona in the writing program there. And I knew it was important, but I had no idea that other people would actually be able to relate to it until I won that award. I had other people look at it and basically tell me that I was, you know, I didn't know how to write a sentence, which is, I guess, in some ways true. I didn't know how to write sentence in certain kinds of English. But I was, you know, just writing what I thought and felt and just in my own my own language. And then I went on to win a few more awards that did help me continue to feel like, okay, it wasn't just a one-off. This is actually something that I might be good at and that I might be able to continue to do.
So could you tell us a little bit about your memoir?
The memoir is called The Molino. It's a story about growing up in my father's tamal and tortilla factory that was in downtown Tucson. It was called El Rápido, and it was opened by my great-grandfather in 1933, and then suddenly had to close at the end of 2000. It was actually the same semester that I was graduating from college, but it was Christmas Eve 2000 when it closed, so it was open for about 67 years. And I grew up in that kitchen. I worked there from a very young age. My brother and I both did. And my father, you know, became an educator to me and my brother in a way that's kind of hard to understand an educator, but he certainly was. And though he wasn't a fantastic businessman, he was immersed in this world of food in a way that even he doesn't necessarily know how to talk about, I think. And my understanding of, you know, of both growing up and being immersed in a kitchen kind of came to life when I started to write about it. It seemed very mundane when I did it as a kid. It took me a lot of work to see it as valuable in another way, just because there was very little money there. There was very little recognition there. And really, the biggest reward in any way was just the food itself. And so I had this fixation on, at first, I think this fixation on having amazing food around me all the time, but also not understanding the value of it in other ways. And so I'm writing about that. I'm writing about some of the history, you know, before I was born, of the space and the gentrification that's kind of taken over in downtown Tucson, and how that kind of affected my family and their business as well. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how the memoir is going to finish, but one of the highlights, I think, that I've been able to get some handle on is the idea of telling the story not just from my perspective, but from the perspective of another narrator. So there's two narrators in the work. One is you know, my own perspective as a child and growing up, and the other narrator is actually a fictional character, and his name is Pensamiento, and in the story you kind of find out who he is.
Our relationship with our bodies can become complicated, in particular in the case of dancers. Could you tell us perhaps a story about how maybe this body issue has come up through flamenco?
For sure, I've had some body issues or complications of understanding the value of my body since I was very, very young. Growing up as a dancer, I think there was always pressure, as there are for most young dancers, to have long limbs, and I don't fit that description. My body is certainly not that, never was, and actually after I've had children, it's farther and further away from that, what people would consider an ideal body for a dancer. And I think when I was in the company, it was okay. It was not necessarily something that came up too often, besides in my own mind. It wasn't something that people necessarily criticized me for. But it was difficult to be in a group of women, because then there's always these comparisons that happen, especially when it comes to costuming and all these other things that happen for productions. And so it was there through all of that, and there was a lot of problems that I had on my own just being able to accept the fact that my body was changing when I got pregnant and afterwards. I would say that most women struggle through that, and then the idealization of the bounce back is another problem. And growing up in a kitchen, as I did, made it kind of a little bit more psychologically crazy, because my relationship with food has never been ideal either. When I finished at the company and came back to Tucson with my husband, we were trying to figure out how to do flamenco on our own in Tucson. And someone gave me some advice that was pretty painful, that I, strangely, at the moment when I was listening to the advice, I actually agreed with. But thinking back on it now, I just realize how wrong that idea was. And basically the person said, well, your husband is a very attractive man. All you need to do is, you know, find a couple of young women who you can train and you'll have a great little company. And of course that excluded me. And I think deep down inside, I knew that was not what I needed to do. It was more of advice for how are you going to at least get started so people will look at you and then you can, you know, bring whatever body you want onto the stage. And that was hard. That was hard to actually believe for myself. That was something that I kind of did to myself in a lot of ways, believing that my body was not an appropriate one for performance, especially when you're trying to gain a new audience. So that was bad advice that I wrongly believed in for a while. And I think maybe there was some resentment, too, of my husband for the same reasons. You know, he was going through the same kinds of things I was going through, but his body didn't change the same way. And so there was no physical reflection of his change. And that seemed to be acceptable for him to just look the way that he always did. But for me to change suddenly wasn't acceptable. Ironically, flamenco doesn't dictate that, at least not the flamenco that I've learned, traditionally speaking, from the place where flamenco was born. That's not really how it operates. But, you know, you move it across the ocean and you put it into the context of American dance and American performance and American stage. And suddenly, you know, you're in our culture where these changes that happen to a body are actually something that needs to be hidden or needs to be closeted in some way. I'm still working through all of that stuff. There's no magic pill to take to, you know, suddenly feel confident in your body. And there's no, you know, number of memes that you can look at on Instagram to make you feel okay. It's just, I think, probably a different process for every person. And for me, it's happening really slowly for me to start to have the realization that I don't have to look a certain way to be a respected artist.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Mele.
Thank you.
This has been Artist Stories with Eva Romero, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. To listen to more podcasts, visit kxci.org. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County.